In a Paris cafe not far from the Charlie Hebdo offices, a young woman in hijab serves coffee to patrons reading headlines about Marine Le Pen's latest anti-immigration speech. This daily interaction embodies the tension at the heart of modern Europe, a continent wrestling with its identity, values, and the very meaning of citizenship. Sasha Polakow-Saransky's Go Back to Where You Came From arrives at a pivotal moment when liberal democracies worldwide face an existential crisis. The book has become required reading among policy experts and has been cited by figures from Barack Obama to Angela Merkel as they grapple with the rise of populist nationalism. What makes this work particularly compelling is how it transcends simplistic narratives, revealing that the greatest threat to Western democracies comes not from immigrants themselves, but from the fear-driven backlash against them, a backlash that risks destroying the very values these societies claim to defend. The apocalyptic vision in Jean Raspail's controversial 1973 novel The Camp of the Saints depicts refugees arriving in France as a peaceful assault on the Western world. His narrator pleads, "Shut your doors, shut them tight if it's not too late," rhetoric that Marine Le Pen would echo during the 2015 refugee crisis. This fictional scenario has become a touchstone for anti-immigrant politicians worldwide, including figures in the Trump administration. Today's immigration debate in wealthy democracies is dominated by two flawed perspectives. The far right portrays newcomers as invaders threatening civilization, while progressives often deny any legitimate concerns exist. Both miss crucial truths. Rapid immigration naturally provokes xenophobic reactions, especially when newcomers compete for jobs and benefits during economic downturns. When combined with terrorist attacks by members of the same ethnic or religious groups, fear creates a potent cocktail that populists expertly exploit. The historical parallels are disturbing. When 15-year-old Jewish refugee Herschel Greinspan assassinated German diplomat Ernst von Rath in 1938, Nazi propagandists immediately weaponized the incident. Goebbels declared, "For once, the Jews should feel the rage of the people," leading to Kristallnacht, state-directed violence against an entire community based on one individual's actions. While today's anti-Muslim backlash hasn't reached such extremes, the rhetoric labeling minorities as scum or calling for de-Islamization carries troubling historical echoes. Philosopher Ernst Cassirer warned that political myths, carefully crafted narratives of collective destiny, can transform constitutional democracies into authoritarian states with frightening speed. During social collapse, rational societies become vulnerable as collective frustrations enable strong leaders to emerge. When this happens, former social bonds, law, justice, and constitutions are declared to be without any value. These political myths never truly vanish, but lurk in the dark waiting for opportunity through skilled manipulation of public opinion. By attacking judges, stripping constitutional protections, and targeting minorities, democracies effectively self-destruct. Since 2015, we've seen the Netherlands authorize stripping citizenship from dual nationals deemed security threats, French cities ban modest swimwear as Islamist, and the Trump administration attempt to bar legal residents while attacking judges who block these orders. These actions represent the beginning of democracy's erosion from within. The Dutch colonial rule over Indonesia was brutal and violent. When they finally departed in 1949, they evacuated their Moluccan allies, housing them in former Nazi transit camps like Westerbork, with empty promises of swift return. By the 1960s, labor shortages led the Netherlands, like Germany, to import Turkish and Moroccan guest workers, a policy initially championed by the free market right rather than the left. No one anticipated the long-term consequences. As temporary workers settled permanently, European countries faced a dilemma: either grant equal rights or maintain a citizenship system based on blood descent. Post-Hitler Europe found the idea of excluding racial or religious groups fundamentally at odds with its values. While restricting entry at borders was acceptable, denying citizenship to admitted residents violated post-war principles. similar patterns emerged across Western Europe. Britain saw unexpected migration from Commonwealth countries, with specific circumstances driving patterns, like Pakistanis displaced by the Mongla Dam relocating to northern England's textile factories. In France, Algerians weren't technically immigrants before 1962, since Algeria was considered part of France. But independence overnight transformed them into foreigners. By the 1980s, the Dutch welfare state was fraying, as foreigners claimed benefits at three times the rate of natives. The country struggled with newcomers unfamiliar with Dutch customs, from open curtains to sexual freedom. Meanwhile, the left shifted from demanding equality to embracing identity politics, particularly after the 1989 Rushdie Fatwa, when religious fundamentalism began attracting disillusioned radicals. For immigrants like Ahmed Marcouch, who arrived from rural Morocco at age 10, the transition was jarring, living in cramped quarters and having to translate for his father, despite minimal education. Though he eventually became a Labour Party MP, he observed that many former Labour voters had shifted to Geert Wilders' far-right party, especially those who had fled changing neighborhoods. This pattern mirrored Britain's experience following Enoch Powell's inflammatory 1968 speech warning of immigrant takeover. Despite minimal non-white population at the time, his message resonated with working-class Londoners who increasingly identified more as an ethnic group united by color and culture than as a class united by their work. Many fled to suburbs but maintained their old identities, becoming a political force that would eventually exact revenge through Brexit. In 1992, newly arrived Somali refugee Ayan Hirsi Ali spent her entire Dutch government assistance check on an extravagant pink and purple carpet for her state-subsidized apartment, a decision that shocked her Dutch friends but seemed perfectly reasonable to someone unaccustomed to budgeting. This cultural disconnect exemplifies the challenges facing Europe's integration efforts. 8 years later, Dutch intellectual Paul Scheffer published The Multicultural Drama, challenging the left's approach to immigration and arguing that subsidized isolation was stifling immigrants' entrepreneurial spirit. This criticism from within the left created political space for Pim Fortuyn, a flamboyantly gay former communist who transformed Dutch politics by opposing Muslim immigration while defending progressive values like women's rights and gay acceptance. After Fortuyn's 2002 assassination, Geert Wilders emerged to fill the political vacuum as traditional Labour voters abandoned the party that had chosen the foreign-born over the labour classes. The 2004 murder of filmmaker Theo van Gogh by a Dutch-Moroccan extremist further polarized Dutch society, creating a profound sense of betrayal among progressives who felt their hard-won liberal values were threatened by orthodox religious practices. The Dutch government attempted to apply its traditional pillarization approach, verzaling, to immigrant communities, treating religious groups as separate pillars within society with their own leadership, which had worked for integrating Catholics. However, this approach failed with Muslim immigrants, who lacked established community leaders. Meanwhile, sociologist Willem Schinkel argues that Holland never truly practiced multiculturalism, but instead used integration to police the boundaries of Dutchness, placing the burden on immigrants while requiring little from Dutch society. The concept of citizenship shifted from formal, having a passport, to moral, adopting Dutch cultural values, with immigrants constantly monitored for their cultural outlook. This created a double standard where Dutch natives weren't measured by the same integration metrics despite many holding conservative religious views. The ubiquitous term allochtoon, foreigner, applied only to non-white immigrants, creating a second-class citizenship that stripped them of their Dutchness regardless of legal status. After 9/11, religious observance became politically charged in the Netherlands. Dutch teens were drinking and having sex while Muslim girls refused to shake hands and insisted on fasting and praying. The clash between progressive Dutch values and conservative Muslim practices created tension that populist politicians exploited. Immigration scholar Rinus Penix warns against targeting specific immigrant groups for re-socialization, comparing such approaches to historical mistreatment of the poor. He argues the government must enforce basic norms, but can't take preemptive action against immigrants specifically. Public health institutions, not integration courses, are better positioned to address issues like female genital cutting. In Denmark, the Danish People's Party, DPP, positioned itself as defender of the welfare state exclusively for native Danes, siphoning working-class votes from Social Democrats. The DPP's message resonated particularly in areas with growing immigrant populations, where residents feared benefits would be buttered more thinly. Social Democratic mayors from Copenhagen's outskirts were among the first to warn that immigration threatened both communities and their party's political dominance. Mayor Thomas Gildal Pedersen of Herlev argues that controlling immigration is necessary to prevent ghetto formation and preserve the welfare state for all residents. The DPP has effectively won virtually every immigration debate, with their vision spreading across Europe, partly because the far right has an instrument the left doesn't have, fear. While scholars once feared anti-immigrant sentiment would lead to welfare state dismantling, the opposite has occurred in Denmark. The DPP has embraced welfare chauvinism, protecting generous benefits exclusively for native Danes while excluding immigrants. DPP leader Shrun Espersen proudly notes that welfare cuts don't win elections in Denmark, as the cradle-to-grave system remains holy to most Danes. Sociologist Aydin Soei, an Iranian immigrant's son, believes Denmark's approach to integration fundamentally misunderstands refugees. Unlike chronically unemployed natives, refugees possess high motivation but lack language skills and cultural knowledge. The welfare system treats them identically to long-term unemployed Danes rather than utilizing their unique strengths and determination. In 2005, Denmark's largest newspaper, Jyllands Posten, published cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad, igniting a global controversy. Culture editor Fleming Rose, who commissioned the cartoons, wasn't an Islamophobe, but a free speech absolutist whose views were shaped by his time as a Moscow correspondent witnessing Soviet censorship. Rose draws parallels between political Islam's intolerance of criticism and Soviet totalitarianism's suppression of dissent. He notes similar patterns emerging with Russian Orthodox Christians, who, once marginalized under communism, now vandalize blasphemous art with state protection. In all these cases, Rose argues, perpetrators were transformed into victims, victims into perpetrators, inverting the concept of tolerance by placing the burden on speakers rather than listeners. British intellectual Kenan Malik criticizes Western liberals for treating self-appointed community leaders as authentic Muslim voices while dismissing moderate Muslims like parliamentarian Nasser Kader. This approach treats minority communities as homogeneous, empowering not communities but leaders who derive influence from their relationship with the state. The cartoon controversy had violent consequences. On New Year's Day 2010, elderly cartoonist Kurt Westergaard, who drew Muhammad with a bomb in his turban, was attacked in his home by an axe-wielding Somali assailant while his 5-year-old granddaughter was present. Westergaard escaped by locking himself in a reinforced bathroom. Since 2007, he and his wife had lived in various safe houses under constant security threats. The Danish cartoon controversy accelerated Denmark's political shift rightward. Many Danes who never considered voting for the Danish People's Party now saw their embassies burning and compatriots threatened over drawings. The DPP's warnings about Muslim extremism suddenly seemed prophetic. Former intelligence chief Jakob Sharp argues that effective counterterrorism requires strong community engagement and a sense of belonging. When communities feel marginalized, they're less likely to help authorities identify extremists. DPP deputy leader Søren Espersen rejects this view, insisting extremism stems purely from religious ideology, regardless of integration efforts. The Danish People's Party has no meaningful integration strategy for immigrants and their Danish-born children beyond demanding they act like Danes, eat pork, attend church, and adopt Christian values. For new arrivals, their only solution is exclusion. This simplistic approach allows them to avoid addressing complex social policy challenges by insisting refugees should simply be sent home. The DPP proudly promotes making Denmark unappealing to refugees, advocating only temporary asylum with the expectation that refugees will leave. Their deputy leader, Espersen, insists, "We don't want to integrate them," and suggests teaching refugee children English rather than Danish to prepare them for eventual departure. The DPP's ultimate goal is to mimic Australia's controversial offshore detention system, where asylum seekers never reach Danish shores. Despite the astronomical costs of Australia's program, approximately $300,000 per detainee, DPP politicians like Kenneth Christensen Berth argue it would be cheaper than integration and serve as a deterrent. This out-of-sight, out-of-mind approach has become increasingly popular among Europe's far-right parties. Australia's offshore detention system originated with the Tampa crisis in August 2001, when a Norwegian freighter rescued 438 asylum seekers and was refused entry to Australian waters. When Captain Rennan declared an emergency and approached Christmas Island, Prime Minister John Howard threatened to prosecute him for people smuggling, and Australian troops forcibly boarded the vessel. The timing proved critical. A federal court initially ruled in favor of the asylum seekers on September 11, 2001, but the government won on appeal days later as the discourse shifted to Muslim terrorists and Muslim boat people. Howard's Pacific solution sent intercepted asylum seekers to detention centers on Nauru, a policy that successfully neutralized the far-right challenge from Pauline Hanson's One Nation party while appealing to suburban working-class voters. Australia's transformation of asylum policy fundamentally changed public attitudes through calculated language manipulation. Officials deliberately framed asylum seekers as illegal, despite there being nothing criminal about seeking asylum without a visa. This linguistic shift, coupled with post-9/11 rhetoric linking asylum with terrorism, justified harsh policies by portraying refugees as security threats rather than vulnerable people. On January 7, 2015, brothers Cherif and Saeed Kouachi stormed the Paris offices of satirical newspaper Charlie Hebdo, killing 12 people, including editor Stéphane Charbonnier. After a 48-hour manhunt, they were killed in a shootout with police. Their accomplice, Amedi Coulibaly, simultaneously took hostages at a kosher supermarket in eastern Paris, killing 4 before being shot by police. Days later, millions marched in Paris to denounce terrorism and defend free speech. The demonstration featured world leaders and France's political establishment, with the notable exception of Marine Le Pen, who was excluded by President François Hollande. Le Pen instead held her own rally in southern France, questioning whether France had done enough to combat the scourge of Islamist terrorism. She later advocated for immigration restrictions, citizenship revocation for jihadists, and reinstated border controls. Following the Brussels terrorist attacks in March 2016, Charlie Hebdo published an editorial by cartoonist Riss that drew disturbing parallels to anti-Semitic rhetoric of the Dreyfus era. Riss portrayed ordinary Muslims, from the veiled woman to the neighborhood halal baker, as unwitting accomplices to terrorism, suggesting they create the conditions that lead to violence. This rhetoric echoes 19th-century anti-Semitic tropes that painted all Jews as threats to the nation. French intellectuals like Alain Finkielkraut reject comparisons between today's anti-Muslim sentiment and historical anti-Semitism, arguing that Jews were peaceful while some Muslims commit acts of terrorism. This ignores how Jewish refugees were once denied entry based on fears of radical Jewish communists and violent Zionists, and how pretext was used to justify collective punishment. The rise of Muslim-focused anxiety has redrawn ideological battle lines, with the Front National shedding its Catholic traditionalism and toxic anti-Semitism to rebrand itself as defender of French secular values. This has created a bridge between the old left and Marine Le Pen's movement, united by cultural anxieties about Islam. The Calais Jungle refugee camp reveals Europe's migration crisis in microcosm. Local residents live just meters from refugee tents, with homes protected by fences bearing dog warnings. At Chez Abdallah Restaurant, a communal charging station in the Afghan section, refugees from multiple countries huddle over phones while planning nighttime attempts to reach Britain, some risking their lives by jumping onto moving trucks. The leaders of Reprenance Calais, Retake Calais, represent the growing anti-immigrant sentiment in the city. These middle-aged men run an online community and produce videos highlighting neighbors' anger about the refugee situation. They explicitly embrace Renaud Camus's Great Replacement Theory, the idea that indigenous French people are being systematically replaced by non-European immigrants. Camus frames immigration as counter-colonization by Muslims seeking mastery of territory and sees the native Frenchman as a replaceable man stripped of cultural specificity. His nostalgia centers on an idealized vision of old France with round fortified villages with narrow streets, the same nostalgic vision that inspires the New Right's intellectuals. Marine Le Pen targets mayors like Damien Carême of Grand Synthe, who took a humanitarian approach to refugees, blaming the EU for encouraging immigration. The European Union has been arguing for years that it would be necessary to welcome millions of immigrants to Europe because of the aging population. She claims the real motive is to put pressure on wages in global competition. Le Pen insists birthright citizenship is a disaster, pointing to the Charlie Hebdo killers who were legally French. This argument traces back to Maurice Barrès, who warned that new French citizens would destroy the special character of our country. Le Pen argues citizenship should require moral screening at age 18 or 20, though her policy would disproportionately scrutinize those with foreign heritage, while native-born French criminals would face no such examination. In France's post-industrial regions, the traditional left's base has shifted dramatically to the far-right Front National. FN campaign manager David Rachline argues the left betrayed workers through globalization, EU treaties, and immigration policies. The Communist Party used to have 5 to 6 million voters. They now vote FN, he claims, because we cannot at the same time defend French workers and support free competition. Marine Le Pen has strategically positioned the FN with left-leaning economic policies while maintaining nationalist values. We defend the interests of the people against great financial powers, she says, criticizing the EU for stripping France of sovereignty. Her populism borrows heavily from the left, combining the legacy of her far-right father with a left-wing program. In Denmark, the Danish People's Party has similarly shifted leftward on social policy, becoming a second working-class party alongside the Social Democrats. With their platforms increasingly aligned on immigration, a future DPP Social Democrat coalition is possible. The DPP strategically remains outside formal coalitions while influencing policy, allowing them to take credit for popular measures while avoiding blame for unpopular ones. In Britain, writer Michael Collins predicted the Brexit protest vote 12 years earlier, warning about neglected working-class whites in poor areas. He criticized how progressive elites who once championed the working class now derided them as chavs, racist and xenophobic. Brexit represented a genuine working class revolt that should have delighted the left, except it opposed their pro-EU stance. John Harris explained to shocked Guardian readers that poor and working class voters overwhelmingly supported leaving, summarized by one woman, "If you've got money, you vote in. If you haven't got money, you vote out." The media elite had missed this entirely, losing touch with their former base while denouncing them rather than engaging with their economic fears about immigration and competition for jobs and housing. Xenophobia transcends the stereotype of wealthy whites rejecting brown Muslims. It's a universal phenomenon arising wherever economic anxiety meets the need for scapegoats. South Africa demonstrates this pattern with black citizens mobilizing against fellow Africans from neighboring countries, mirroring European anti-immigrant sentiment, but receiving less international attention because both victims and perpetrators are black. South African blacks' grievances mirror those of working-class Europeans, like British East Enders who felt their post-war gains were snatched away by immigrants. Black South Africans who gained freedom after apartheid felt entitled to redress from the state. Instead, they faced competition from better-educated foreigners from Congo and Somalia willing to work for less. Mary Lau exemplifies this contradiction, a lesbian former young communist who volunteers with brown children yet campaigns against foreigners in her neighborhood. Despite her initial optimism after apartheid's end in 1994, she now blames Nelson Mandela for opening the doors to immigrants she associates with crime and economic hardship, declaring citizens slaves of this democracy, not recipients. The 2009 film District 9 wasn't merely science fiction, but a thinly veiled portrayal of South Africa's xenophobic violence. The scenes of locals advocating violence against aliens were based on actual footage of South Africans discussing immigrants. Just a year earlier, anti-immigrant mobs had killed 60 people, displaced 100,000, and destroyed 30,000 homes. Immigrants in South Africa face brutal violence with little protection. Baron Mukeba, a Congolese man, survived an axe attack but received no justice. The police didn't even try. Immigrants have created defensive enclaves like Yeovil in Johannesburg, once a Jewish neighborhood, now filled with Congolese and Ethiopian restaurants, a stronghold where xenophobic gangs fear to enter. Like Europe's white identity politicians warning of Muslim usurpers, many black South Africans view African immigrants as new colonizers preventing them from enjoying hard-won liberty. The government dismisses xenophobic violence as mere crime, without political motivation, a convenient distinction echoing the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's approach. After the AfD's electoral gains in Merkel's home state of Mecklenburg and Berlin, Merkel admitted she would turn back time to better prepare for the 2015 refugee crisis, though maintaining her policy was absolutely right. Within her CDU party, dissent grew, exemplified by Jens Spahn's public challenge over dual citizenship laws. The AfD began as an anti-EU movement focused on sovereignty and opposition to Greek bailouts, taking nearly 5% in 2013 elections and winning 7 EU parliament seats in 2014. Christian Schmidt, an early member, describes how the party was quickly hijacked by extremists, conspiracy theorists, and those with anti-immigrant views. Frauke Petri emerged as leader in 2015, adopting strident anti-immigration positions and forcing out founder Bernd Lucke. In Béziers, France, Mayor Robert Menard exemplifies the rightward shift of former leftists on immigration issues. Though supported by the Front National, he criticizes Marine Le Pen's anti-EU stance and statist economic program while sharing her hardline immigration views. Menard, once a Trotskyist, claims his transformation came from witnessing integration failures in local schools. Jean Raspal, the controversial author of The Camp of the Saints, believes the Front National was more effective as a provocative force raising uncomfortable issues than as a party seeking governance. He predicts France's demographic collapse, declaring, "We will become a minority, we white Europeans," comparing the situation to civilizations absorbed ethnically, intellectually, legally. He ominously concludes, "There is something that will explode, but something will explode." Nationalism remains a powerful force that progressives ignore at their peril. As Isaiah Berlin noted, nationalism represents the inflamed desire of the insufficiently regarded to count for something. The author argues that dismissing national sentiment as backward is perilous, as even cosmopolitan elites occasionally feel nostalgia for home. Those who lack education and mobility often resent those with options and compensate by strongly identifying with place, supporting politicians who promise protection from threats. Liberal democracies must effectively address these challenges or risk their own destruction as xenophobic populists hijack public debate, potentially undermining rights for immigrants and minorities, and, in worst cases, reviving the ugliest nationalist ideologies of the 20th century. The greatest threat to liberal democracies comes not from immigrants, but from the backlash against them. A backlash that, if left unchecked, will transform these democracies into hollow shells of their former selves.